All rise, the Court of Appeals Division 1 is now in session.
Thanks, folks. Go ahead and have a seat. All right, this is the time set for oral argument in 1 CACV 240708, Trevor Smith, the AFC Gamma, Inc. These proceedings are being recorded, counsel. So when you do approach the podium, please state your name and identify the party you represent for the record. It is also being simulcasted, so that way folks know who you are and who you represent. We have read the briefs. We have conferenced before we came here today, so we are familiar with the issues. You'll each have 20 minutes per side. If you are going to divide that time, that is up to you. It would be helpful if you at least identify that as such so that we know what we're expecting. We don't keep track of your time beyond the clock. If you want to reserve any time for rebuttal, you're welcome to tell us, but we're not going to protect that time for you. So keep an eye on the clock as you're doing the oral argument. You do have the 20 minutes. You're not obligated to use it, but if you need it, please feel free to use it as you need. With that, counsel, if you would like to begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Steve Jerome, and along with my colleague James Florentine, we represent appellants AFC Gamma Inc. and AFC Agent LLC, which I will collectively refer to as AFC. As to allocation of time, I'm going to try to reserve approximately 7 to 8 minutes, depending on how many questions I get and how fast I can get through my prepared materials. Before I start my prepared comments, does the court have any questions that they'd like me to address at the outset?
I think we'll let you get started. Certainly, they'll come up.
All right. So in preparing for this oral argument and reviewing the record in briefs, it felt akin to preparing almost for a law school exam of issue spotting. There are a number of issues in this case, voluminous issues, and I'm not going to be able to address every single one that's raised in the briefs to its full steps. We could spend 20 minutes just talking about some of the Article 9 and UCC issues that are addressed tangentially in various aspects of the briefing. So I'm going to try to keep it focused on what I'll consider the more germane issues. Prior to the initiation of the underlying litigation and the appointment of a receiver over Devi, Devi sold its interest in two companies. At the close of the sale, AFC was paid the net sales proceeds as the secured creditor. Plaintiffs as unsecured creditors of Devi objected to AFC receiving this payment. However, it is important to note that there is nothing illegal, immoral, improper about a secured creditor being paid the proceeds of the sale of its collateral. Undaunted, plaintiffs initiated litigation against Devi, AFC, and Story, the purchaser of the pre-receivership sale. However, instead of trying to prove their claims against AFC, plaintiffs convinced the receiver to essentially subordinate AFC's liens in the proceeds from a different sale and impose a blanket constructive trust more akin to equitable subordination of AFC's lien without discovery, trial. AFC was not even served with the underlying complaint. So before I get into a more robust discussion, I briefly want to address jurisdiction and standard of review. I don't think jurisdiction is contested here, but for the record, I believe both we have appellate jurisdiction under ARS 12-2101A4 and 12-2101A1. With respect to standard of review, as this court has noted in both Robson Ranch and Rohan Management, questions of law and mixed questions of law of fact are reviewed de novo. As the Court of Appeals and State XRL versus Torres. Due process violations are also reviewed de novo, and I don't believe the plaintiffs contest that. As the Court of Appeals in Cal Extra versus WVSV Holdings, courts review the availability of equitable relief and defenses thereto also de novo. And then as set forth in Gravels Resources, MCA Financial, and UMB, these are all cases cited in our briefing. Courts often apply a de novo standard to reviewing issues that arise in receivership cases.
Counsel, maybe it would help to start with this. Your client agreed to the receivership process, correct?
Yes and no. After the fact, we contested it, and then there was a stipulated order. So the initial order, I think, was entered without our consent, and then we did consent to the amended order, yes.
Okay. And so your client agreed to the process?
Yes, sir.
And a deal's a deal?
A deal's a deal.
So where did the deal go wrong? Why should we set aside a deal that your client voluntarily entered into?
Because, again, it's what is the scope of the deal? What are the rights, duties, and powers of a receiver? A receiver here, because you have a multi-defendant complaint. The plaintiffs asserted claims against Debbie and asked for the appointment of a receiver against Debbie. Nothing in that receivership order says the receiver litigates, determines, adjudicates claims between the plaintiffs and AFC. There's no provision in that order that says that's what the receiver is supposed to do. And that would be outside Rule 66 and the application of most receivership practice.
But did the order say all claims would be, or the receivership's duties would be strictly limited to the exact claims in the lawsuit? Did it say that specifically?
No, but if you look at the actual receivership order, nothing in there says it's the receiver has the obligation or duty, and nothing under Rule 6D6 or the statutes authorizing the appointment of receivers address the receiver adjudicating claims between what I'll call two non-receivership entity parties. We have a plaintiff and a defendant. AFC is not, there's no receiver over AFC, and there is no receiver over plaintiffs. And so there's an independent claim. And so the relief of receivership was against one defendant. AFC is a separate defendant. There are 2.5 claims pled in the complaint against AFC that have never been prosecuted or proven. And that is tortious interference. It is a civil conspiracy. And I say half claim because the declaratory relief claim, it's uncertain whether we are or we're not a defendant to that claim based upon the pleading in the complaint itself.
Mr. Jerome, but there was no confusion or lack of understanding on the part of your client about why they were there, correct, or what the Smith Group was seeking.
No, the Smith Group was seeking to attempt to collect the money that they believed that they were owed, which was an unsecured claim. Even the order appointing the receivership says it's an unsecured claim. So nothing in that order changed the law of secured transactions, where secured creditors get paid before unsecured creditors. That's the whole benefit of being a secured creditor. You have both an in rem claim and an in personam claim as a secured creditor, where an unsecured creditor only has an in personam claim. And so nothing in that order says we're reversing legal rights. There's not a single provision in that order.
What did your client think it was going to get out of the receivership when it agreed to it? I mean, I'm confused because your client entered an agreement to do the receivership. I don't know, what do you say the purpose was for your client?
I think the purpose for the client was, I think AFC would agree with the plaintiffs that Debbie has issues. Debbie had issues and was operating probably inappropriately. So the receiver there is not to protect the rights of the plaintiffs. It's to protect the rights as a court officer of all parties. It's again, a receivership is not to operate as a magistrate or a commissioner and adjudicate claims between non-entities that the receiver has no control over. So the receiver essentially comes in and operates as the new chairman, CEO, court-appointed of Debbie. It operates the rights of Debbie as supplemented by the order. And so what my client thought it was getting was a more responsible person to oversee the affairs of Debbie. Because my client is owed a significant sum of money by Debbie, significantly more than the plaintiffs, more than $80 million. And it has collateral that Debbie has all over the country. And so, again, what we thought we were getting out of this was a court officer who would mind the store in a more appropriate fashion than was occurring prior to the appointment of the receiver.
And so it's not that what you just said suggests that it's not that you didn't expect the receiver to act the way it did. You didn't expect it to make the decision it did, which was to protect that unsecured obligation.
No, I would phrase it this way. So when you look at that February 1 transcript, so you have a pre-receivership stale that the plaintiffs contend we absconded with their money that they had an in rem right. They didn't, but that's their position. They sued for tortious interference and civil conspiracy based on that conduct. Post-receivership, the receiver sold a completely different set of assets. than what was sold pre-receiver, because that pre-receivership sale had closed, the money had been dispersed, it never became property of the receivership estate. Post the appointment of the receiver sold something completely unrelated. The parties then had a dispute of who gets the proceeds from the sale, plaintiffs as an unsecured creditor, or ASC as a purported unsecured, or as a purported secured creditor. And they disputed our collateralization. And if you read that February 1, 31-page transcript, there was discussions about having an asset-by-asset determination of whether or not AFC had a valid and perfected lien on it, and then what was the priority of that lien, assuming it had one, vis-a-vis...
And Judge Curry was pretty detailed in going through that.
Correct. But if you look at the conduct, what he did was impose a remedy for a claim that was never litigated. Because the conduct that Judge Corey focused on was the conduct that happened pre-receivership that forms the allegation set forth in the complaint for which there's never been prosecuted. There's been no discovery, no trial. So to impose a remedy of a constructive trust, you first have to adjudicate and have liability on a claim. What claim did Judge Corey determine that AFC was liable on? I have no idea. It doesn't say. It goes straight to remedy. And not only did it misapply the remedy, I mean, you can't have a constructive trust requires over a specific trust rests, not over assets at a whole. What it really was an equitable subordination of a lien, which is not a theory recognized under Arizona law, because it didn't impose a constructive trust on the assets that AFC allegedly wrongfully acquired from the pre-receivership sale. It imposed it on every other asset owned by Debbie that AFC asserts a lien on. So, again, when you look at what happened, that transcript, there's no discussion of the receiver analyzing the conduct of the disputed conduct pre-receivership. There's no discussion of the receiver acting as a court and making a recommendation. There's no discussion of the what would happen, you know, that there is a waiver of rights to go to have present evidence, to have a trial.
Mr. Jerome, I understand that maybe those issues were not discussed in the February 1st transcript, but subsequent to that, the receiver engaged in a fairly thorough and detailed fact-finding process, and I realize that you were not representing AFC Gamma at that time. It was different counsel. But it seems to me that it became very clear through that fact-finding process exactly what the Smith Group was seeking and the basis therefore, and your client, albeit represented by someone else, did not object at any point to the direction that this factual investigation was going.
And Your Honor, I disagree in the sense that I do think through the objection, we said this is beyond the purview of what was agreed to. This was beyond the scope. You have imposed an equitable remedy before we have been a judge liable on any claim. No claim has been prosecuted. And so we did. Once we looked.
Well, you did at the point where we already have the recommendation from the receiver. We're already at the end. At the end of the investigation, the very thorough investigation that the receiver conducted.
We don't know how thorough because we don't know exactly what the receiver, there is no record of what the receiver, who the receiver talked to, what documents they looked at, whether the information they obtained in their informal interviews was admissible or not, whether the documents they reviewed were admissible or not. We don't have an inventory of the documents. We don't even have a declaration by the receiver of what the receiver did. The entire recommendation is a pleading filed by receiver's counsel, has zero evidentiary value. And from that, Judge Corey made findings of fact.
But your client didn't object until the end. Why should we give relief? I mean, once you knew, or your client knew, again, represented by other counsel, that it was going into turf that you now take the position that it shouldn't have, why didn't your client object then?
And again, the issue is it's one of in the record. There is no record of the communications between AFC through its prior counsel and the receiver, but there were both parties submitted papers to the receiver and indicated their various positions on whether or not it was appropriate for the receiver. The receiver then rejected AFC's position and entered the room. Did AFC take the position in the non-filed documents substantially similar to the position it took in the filed documents? Yes. But those weren't filed because that was done in the context of the informal process with the receiver. But that objection was made. It's just neither the receiver nor the parties put those in front of the court because, again, it was at that point the receiver was going through an informal process. And the receiver's recommendation itself says no party is waiving its due process rights. And it says it's a close call. And how do you have a close call when the standard for imposition of constructive trust is clear and convincing evidence?
So it could be a close call.
It could be a close call. But again, and then what evidence did Judge Curry rely on? What record is there for you to review to determine that Judge Curry made appropriate factual findings based upon no evidence submitted? What claim was AFC a judge liable for which it appropriate is appropriate to impose a constructive trust? We don't know because the record doesn't have any of that. We went from allegation to remedy and skipped discovery and trial. And we went straight to imposition.
What case law says you have to have discovery and trial in receivership?
Again, it's not in receivership that you need discovery and trial. It's in a claim. This is not
we're in a different field. We're in a different field of play. I mean, I think I need your help.
There's no case law that I'm aware of that allows a receiver to adjudicate a claim between entities.
The receiver didn't adjudicate, the court did.
Based on what the receiver's determination.
Right.
That still requires
a recommendation, correct?
It was a recommendation. Yes. And from that recommendation, which was non-evidentiary, the court made findings of fact, conclusions of law, adjudged AFC liable on some claim.
Who are three individuals, Trevor Smith, Judah Holland, and actually the estate of Joseph Gimbel. We commonly refer to them as the Smith Group. The issue in this appeal from our perspective is whether Judge Curry's decision to impose the constructive trust in favor of the Smith Group using the process that the parties agreed to and using the same process that AFC used prior to the recommendation in the Smith Group's favor, whether that decision to impose a constructive trust is supported by reasonable evidence. We believe that's the standard. We also believe that given the record in front of this court, the answer is clearly and abundantly yes, it was supported by reasonable evidence.
What's the evidence? So you just said there's none. What's the evidence?
So the evidence, you can look at Judge Corey's order, July 30th, 2024 order, and he set forth the evidence that he relied upon. The evidence... Trust, just to be clear, is over the assets of the receivership estate. Those are Debbie's assets. It's not a constructive trust over AFC. And I think that's the disconnect from AFC's briefing. We don't have we're not seeking to disgorge the money they took from the plaintiffs. So, and if you think about their position on this issue, what they say is, well, these assets over here is what plaintiff is what so the Smith Group seeks, you know, call it $3.5 million of money over here. And AFC pre-lawsuit came in and took that money. Then we have a lawsuit, then we have a receiver, then we have a constructive trust over the remaining assets. And AFC now says, we have a super, super protective lien over these assets, and therefore you can't touch your $3.5 million. Well, how convenient. They already took the $3.5 million out of the estate. And I think that's the disconnect in their briefing, is that we're not seeking to, you know, disgorge that money from them. What Judge Corey did was put a constructive trust over the assets of the estate up to the amount of what the Smith Group is owed, because AFC already took it. So when they say, well, we have a lien, we have a claim, you know, we have this, they're in second position, they're subordinate, that I think that misses the point. The point is they already took our money and we're entitled to some protection up to that amount. The Judge Corey also noted and concluded, based upon the evidence in front of him, you know, the arguments, the briefing, et cetera, that AFC did not have any lien on our change of control payment, our $3.5 million. And he goes into quite detail about why that is. For example, it was from the sale of a cannabis company. By federal law, AFC can't have a lien in that. Their SEC disclosures say they have no lien in it. Nowhere in their UCC filings do they include Arizona Natural Pain Solutions, which was the entity that was sold. Even in their own loan documents, they carve it out, right? And you can go through all the different analysis that we talk about in our briefing, and you can see, and you can follow Judge Corey's thought process from his pretty detailed order about why he concluded that even if this money were still in the estate, AFC would have no lien to it. It was a contractual obligation owed to us. I do want to, and forgive me, Judge, if I didn't answer your question. I tried to, but if I didn't.
I think you did.
Okay. All right. Feel free to let me know if I didn't. I do want to talk a little bit about the waiver issue, because I think this is an important issue. There was no secret about the process that everyone agreed to. It actually started in January of 2024 when... So that's after the order appointing receivership is entered, and then AFC comes in and says, we'd like to make some changes, and we worked together as counsel to figure out what those changes were, and Judge Corey was very clear, go work out what you want in changes to be and bring it to me, and we'll talk about it. And so we did. That happened in January of 2024, and that's where the beginnings of the receiver is going to have to sell assets, bring the proceeds from those assets to the estate, and then we'll figure out how they get dispersed. And there's clearly going to be a dispute between the Smith Group and AFC, but we will figure that out. That then led to the hearing in February, where Judge Corey had everyone on the phone and said, this is my expectation. Anyone have any comment? You can read the transcript. I think it was fairly clear that it was all agreed to. And then immediately the next day, he issues his minute entry, which says, this is the process. Nowhere from January of 2024 until the receiver issues its recommendation in, I believe it was late June, early July 2024. Nowhere once did AFC say, wait a second, this process is unfair. We need discovery. You know, we need a trial. We need a hearing. And what's also very interesting for us is that, remember, our recommendation was the second recommendation. The first recommendation was in AFC's favor. They got almost $10 million using the same process that everyone agreed to in February of 2024, and that was set forth in Judge Corey's minute entry. So when they come now on appeal and they say, we didn't have our due process rights, we needed a trial, we need a hearing, we need this, we need that, certainly didn't need it when they used the process. And I think it's fairly evident.
But there was no objection to that first payment, was there?
There was no objection, but that's also, I think, a little bit of a red herring when they say that, because the process was, number one, a recommendation, and that happened the first time with AFC's money. And then second, either party could then object. So there was no objection on the second step of the process, but that's different than saying there was no objection. Like, we didn't object to the process. It was within that process we had an objection right. We elected not to make it because we thought it was, you know, the right thing to do at that moment in time. But the process was the same. So AFC used that process. And the fact that we didn't object is just the second step in that same process. The receiver then and the court then used the same process to reach a recommendation in the Smith Group's favor. That was the first step. The second step is they have the right to object. They did. That's their right. That's the process. And then we had the right to essentially reply, which we did. And then Judge Corey makes the final decision, of course, and he made his decision. So the process was the same for the two recommendations that have existed.
Where in this process did the concept of a constructive trust come up?
Yeah, sure. So that came up when the receiver started doing his investigation. So just to back up for 30 seconds. After AFC received the first payout from the recommendation, the $9.7 million, AFC and the Smith Group went to the receiver collectively and said, we now want you to use the same process to make a recommendation on other proceeds that have come into the receivership estate. So the receiver, through his counsel, started doing their investigation.
And do we have that anywhere in the record that we can point to, that the two sides coming to the receiver and saying, we want you to adjudicate this particular claim or whatever you want to call it?
Yeah, so yes, the best place, I mean, it's not the greatest place, but the best place to look is in the receiver's recommendation when he sets forth, kind of lays the groundwork for why they, like, what's happened to get to this point in time. And the receiver's counsel talks about that issue. So that's where I would look. And so during this kind of initial, you know, in-person meetings and fact gathering and exchanging documents and, you know, providing analysis between us, you know, the Smith Group, AFC, and the receiver's counsel brings up the concept of we may be headed for a constructive trust. And then that ultimately, you know, they made no representations because they had to complete their analysis, but ultimately you then see that, of course, in the recommendation. And what's interesting is, again, this is a recommendation by the receiver over Devi to impose a constructive trust over Devi's own assets. And that was, you know, really Devi's recommendation through the receiver to the court to protect the Smith Group. And again, just to kind of put a final point on the waiver argument.
And I'm sorry to interrupt
please,
you there. Based on the conduct of Devi or based on the conduct of AFC or both?
Both. Because they eventually became married as one. And they essentially, it's a little bit overly dramatic, but they basically became one in the same company. Because you had AFC designees sitting on the Devi board. You know, you had AFC, you know, intimately involved in whether to consent to the transaction between Devi and Story Cannabis. You know, you had AFCs, you know, frankly, their fingerprints are all over this, in every which way you could imagine. And that's why, in part, why the receiver recommended and then Judge Corey ultimately concluded that there was no secret here. AFC knew exactly what was going on and what was happening. And they used their economic leverage to force Devi to not pay the Smith Group, instead to take that money and turn around and pay it back to AFC, who was the lender, frankly, on both sides. They're also the lender for Story Cannabis, so they knew what was going on from both sides of the transaction. Another just brief issue for you all is, and I know you know this, but I think it's important to underscore, we are operating in a different playing field, I think was maybe the phrase used, because we are in receivership. So the case law is pretty clear that in a receivership, you know, the rules are they're just different, and the trial courts have more flexibility, more discretion to figure out not only a way to orderly administer the assets of the receivership and the potential competing claims, so not only to set the process that makes equitable sense, right? Principles of equity are governing all of this, not only the process, but also the result. And that's clearly what Judge Corey did here. I think he tried to get control of this receivership action early on. And he set the, he brought the parties together, he set the process, and then he used that process to reach his recommendation. So,
Mr. Mature, please address the point made by your opponent regarding evidence, whether, what the receiver considered was evidence or admissible evidence, whether they may have gone outside the rules of evidence and considered things that maybe the receiver should not have considered or would not have considered in a more traditional trial setting.
Yes, absolutely. First of all, there was never a request by AFC that the receiver could only rely upon admissible evidence. Then when Judge Corey issued his order on February 1st, or his minute entry on February 1st, where it sets forth, it just says that the receivers to, and I can't remember the exact phraseology, but just, I think, review information or documents. I can't remember the exact words. But if AFC believed at that time, if it really believed that this was going to be a recommendation based solely upon admissible evidence, you would think it would have filed something with Judge Corey to say so, whether it's a motion for reconsideration, a Rule 16 conference to talk about it. You know, something would have been in the record where AFC would have said, well, wait a second, we need admissible evidence. But also, don't forget, this is the second recommendation. The first recommendation, no one was screaming about admissible evidence. AFC was not requiring the receiver to rely upon admissible evidence when it recommended a payment to AFC.
And does that necessarily waive that objection as to the second payment?
I think it's informative of what was really going on in AFC's mind at that time. And then we also don't receive, and so let's move forward. We get the receivers, so it was a process to get the recommendation. It just didn't happen overnight, obviously. It was an investigatory process. Nowhere in there are we seeing any, you know, AFC is submitting information, we're submitting information, et cetera. The receiver is going back and forth. No one is making demands about admissible evidence. The first time any issue comes up on admissible evidence is when AFC receives a recommendation it didn't like. And suddenly we see a flurry of activity about object to this, object to that, object to this, object to that. One of those being admissible, you know, no admissible evidence. Judge Corey, in the very beginning of his minute entry from July 30th of 2024, one of the very first things he says is, this matter has been exceptionally well briefed by all parties. I don't believe oral argument would be necessary. So what does that tell us? That tells us that Judge Corey felt comfortable with the information in front of him. And certainly if he had a question about, you know, admissibility, I assume he would have brought the parties together. But admissible evidence is just one of a litany of issues that suddenly arose when, for the first time, AFC didn't receive a decision that it liked. I'll talk briefly, if I could, just about the standard of review, since it was brought up. I think that the Hyatt case controls. I think that the Hyatt case is fairly clear, and it deals with a receivership action, and it talks about the principles of equity, and it says very clearly that equitable remedies rendered by the judge in a receivership action will not be disturbed on appeal absent an abuse of discretion. So the remedy, the equitable remedy here of a constructive trust, we believe is reviewed by this court under an abuse of discretion standard.
What about the underlying factual findings that lead to that remedy?
So I believe that's also an abuse of discretion standard. The one area where I think a de novo might apply is if this were a traditional due process case. I don't think that this is a due process case. Again, and we can talk about that if that is would be helpful to the court. But Judge Corey's findings of fact and his July 30th, 2024 order, I believe, which ultimately then leads to the conclusion of a constructive trust, I think is reviewed under abuse of discretion. And I think we cite the case law in our brief that talks about that. If the court has no further questions, I'll give you back some time, and I'll just end on this, which is that principles of equity are governing everything that we're talking about here today and everything that's happened to the Smith Group over the last 2 years. And it's almost a year. Tomorrow will be a year to the day since Judge Corey issued his order, final order for the receiver to pay the Smith Group. And yet still, you know, here we are fighting about it. I think at the end of the day, the issue is that there was a fair process that the parties agreed to that ultimately led to a decision in the Smith Group's favor, and getting a do-over because you don't like the result is not a reason to overturn or to disturb Judge Corey's order. So we'd ask that you affirm his order. Thank you very much.
While receiverships are governed in equity, they are not a roving commission to take vested property rights without due process. Nothing in Arizona receivership case law says that you can divest a party of its lien. And I think it's a interesting, cute way to say, well, they put a constructive trust over Debbie. It's not the fact that they put a constructive trust over Debbie's assets. It's that they subordinated a valid and perfected lien. The receiver found AFC had a valid and perfected lien.
But did that lien necessarily attach to all of the funds that were in the receivership estate?
The funds related to this disposition. The receiver found in his report, yes, in the recommendation, and that finding was not appealed. There's no cross appeal on the receiver's determination that AFC had a valid and perfected lien on the on the assets that were sold, and therefore under the operational law has a valid and perfected lien on the proceeds. Yet the constructive trust is now senior to that. So we've now subordinated AFC's valid and perfected lien. Those are property rights. Those were taken with no due process. And I find it ironic about the whole concept, because you're right, there was no objection to the first sale, and the admissible evidence substantiating AFC's entitlement to the first distribution is the same to the second. It's its loan documents. There's no dispute that our loan documents are valid, effective, that they've been authenticated. I mean, we supplied, with our objection, a declaration laying the foundation, attaching our UCC-1s. They're also wrong on the UCC, and so with all due respect, Judge Corey, because you don't have to specifically name entities. They're considered general intangibles, and they fall within the definition of general intangibles under the Uniform Commercial Code, so you don't have to list out every membership interest that you have a lien in. It falls within a broad category.
Do you have a single case that says it's abuse of discretion in a receivership to subordinate that secure interest? Is there a case out there that says the court has no jurisdiction to do this, anything that we can line up on all fours?
No, but conversely, there is no case that says a receiver can.
No, but we do have pretty strong case law that says the receivership, under a receivership, the court has some pretty broad authority and to deal with equity.
Right.
Not necessarily every legal claim.
Right. But the difference here is that there is no claim in Arizona for equitable subordination of a lien. That doesn't exist under Arizona law. It is in other insolvency-related proceedings, for example, under the Bankruptcy Code, there is a claim for equitable subordination. That does not exist under Arizona law. But that, even if it existed under Arizona law, it goes back to the notice and process. When you read that February transcript, there's no discussion of that there's going to be an examination by the receiver of pre-receivership conduct, make a determination, and then as a result of that determination, adjudicate AFC did something wrong and impose a remedy against AFC by subordinating its lien on no evidence and no process. Because, you know,
you say no process, but there was a process here. It maybe was not the traditional litigation process, but it was a process that at least they are arguing your client agreed to.
Right. And what we agreed to, again, if you read the transcript, was an asset by asset evaluation of, for every widget that was sold, did AFC have a lien on it? If it didn't, what happened? If it did, is that lien senior in priority to an unsecured claim? That was the process. There was no discussion about determining whether or not AFC was liable, and because again, equitable remedy of constructive trust requires some sort of bad conduct, malfeasance, breach of fiduciary duty by AFC. There's no discussion that that's what we're going to be adjudicating through the receiver's recommendation. And I can drive that home. If the court affirms, they will have to dismiss their underlying claims against AFC that are pending because they're not entitled to a double recovery. Exactly the money that they're suing us for, the receiver is giving them. So they were able to achieve through the receivership what they couldn't, they chose not to try to prove. We lost that whole proving us, and that was our response.
But was there some mystery about what they were seeking and how? I mean, throughout this process, was your client surprised that this
yes,
is what they were after?
They were surprised that was ended up being the subject of the receiver's recommendation because it goes beyond what was on the record. So, yes, they were surprised by that. And that's when they objected. As Mr. Matura indicated, there was back and forth unofficially, you know, off the record between the parties with the receiver before he filed it. We objected to what the receiver was doing. We were told that was, you know, again, the receiver was still going to go for it. But again, there was nothing in the record authorizing the receiver to basically adjudicate those pre-litigation, pre-receivership claims to then grant a post-receivership remedy in the favor of the plaintiffs. So unless the court has any other questions.
Is there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your attention here today. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision in due course.